Good morning. So let me briefly recapitulate the key results from yesterday. So yesterday we introduced an important structure for general relativity which can live on the manifold, which is the metric. So the metric is simply a symmetric non-degenerate 0-2 tensor. So it likes to eat vectors. So it eats two vectors, produces a number. And so that's what 0-2 tensor means. And it's non-degenerate, meaning if I take it as a matrix, I will find that all its eigenvalues are non-trivial. In fact, we require that the eigenvalues are limited to be of pseudo-Riemannian signature. That means one of the eigenvalues will be negative, while the other three eigenvalues will be positive. All right, and that's what metric is. And of course, because we have a non-degenerate object, we can also introduce an inverse metric, G minus 1, which will be 2-0 tensor. So G minus 1 will like to eat forms. And so now you can feed two forms, mu and omega, and it gives you the real number if it's at a point or it's a function on the manifold. All right. Outside. All right. It will spin. Okay. Maybe. Let's put it. Is this better? Okay, so we solved the problem. Perfect. So now, in general relativity, you impose two important restrictions on the manifold. So one of them is that although you have connection present as well, so that you can covariantly differentiate tensors, you require that the connection is such that the associated tensor, which is the antisymmetric part of the connection, which is called torsion tensor, vanishes. So that's one requirement in general relativity. The other requirement is that you can covariantly differentiate the metric, and you get an object which has three indices. It's called metricity tensor, and you require that this object vanishes as well. So these are the assumptions of general relativity, and once you impose these assumptions, your connection is already completely determined by the metric. And it's the connection as you know it. It's the connection given by the Christoffel symbols. Okay, so here is the formula here.
Okay, why do we require that? Just to have that connection? I mean, we can go with another connection, right?
Sure.
So it is not
So,
like a real requirement.
no. So this is the assumption of general relativity. You can now start building theories which are more general. And so you may require that maybe I have a torsion as an independent field on the manifold, which sort of describes gravitational field as well. Or maybe you can say, well, my metricity tensor is not zero, and then I have something more complicated. So typically, you know, once you abandon these two conditions, your connection will be independent of the metric, and you have to specify connection independently and the metric independently. And so you are basically describing a theory where you have more degrees of freedom, right? So you can do that, of course. But the simplest assumption is that you don't do that. Connection is simply determined completely from the metric, and that's general relativity. Other questions? All right, so then we have this very important equivalence principle, and so the mathematical formulation of this principle is that at a point, and it's close by neighborhood, I can always set the metric to be equal to the flat metric. And I can set the first derivatives of the metric equal to zero, meaning that the Christoffel symbols at a point will also be equal to zero. Okay? So in fact, this can be actually extended not to be true only at a point, but it can be extended along a geodesic. So you can basically build a frame T and xi, which is sort of propagated along any geodesic gamma, and then along this geodesic, the observer who is actually moving along this geodesic will always see the metric which is flat and always see that the Christoffel symbols R0. Okay, and so the special coordinates which you have to introduce so that this is true are called Fermi coordinates, and Fermi is the same Fermi, the famous physicist, and the nuclear physicist. Okay, and so he also dealt with general relativity, and he was quite a character. All right, so now we did this counting argument, and we were sort of not proving this relationship at a point. And so what I was arguing for is that, well, maybe you can keep going, maybe I can choose my coordinates so that maybe I could actually vanish also the second derivatives of the metric. But then we actually encountered the problem is that we had 100 equations to impose. So this is 10 times 10, so if I require this is equal to 0, I have 100 equations, but we had only 80 components to tune, so only 80 variables which we could, you know, use. And so there is at least 20 components of the second derivatives which do not vanish. And I told you, well, this is actually good because these 20 components will be captured by some important Riemann tensor. So Riemann tensor will actually carry the information about these 20 non-trivial components of the second derivatives of the metric. So it captures information. Captures information about second derivatives of the metric. Derivatives of the metric. And of course, since it is a tensor, I cannot simply vanish it by going to some coordinate frame. So it's impossible to. In general, it's impossible to make the Riemann tensor to vanish, and that means it's impossible to get rid of the second derivatives of the metric in general. So just check that you are actually paying attention. So can I write down a tensor which would have first derivatives of the metric, and which would be non-vanishing? Do you see any example of such tensor which would contain first derivatives of the metric on the blackboard?
It cannot be.
So it's the metricity tensor here, right? So the metricity tensor contains the first derivatives of the metric, but I am imposing that it actually vanishes. So now the statement is there is no any other tensor which you could write which depends only on the metric and its first derivatives. Okay, on the first derivatives of the metric, which would be actually non-trivial. So now if you go to second derivatives of the metric, the tensor which is non-trivial is unique and it's the Riemann tensor here. All right. So now the last thing I want to cover regarding the metric is the invariant volume element. Invariant volume element. And so this will be quite important when we actually formulate general relativity from the variational principle, as we shall do. And so for the variational principle, you need to know how to write down the integral over the volume of the spacetime. And to that purpose, we need to know what this volume is. Yes?
I thought about the Riemann tensor. So if we want to have the equivalence principle and we want to have second derivatives, then it is going to be a consequence that we, as a consequence, we will have a Riemann tensor.
You will see a theorem very soon. But exactly, so you know, all non-trivial components of the second derivatives are captured by this Riemann tensor. And it's precisely that many components. The Riemann tensor will have 20 components. And so it can capture all these non-trivial derivatives.
So for example, if we want to go to third derivatives, we're not going to find a tensor like that.
Okay, so I'm not going to higher order. So if you go to higher order, of course I can maybe covariantly differentiate the Riemann tensor. And that will have three derivatives.
So the equivalence principle is up to.
So the equivalence principle is telling me I can have locally the metric flat, and I can have gammas to vanish. That's what the equivalence principle is, right? But I cannot go to higher derivatives of G. So that will certainly not vanish. Riemann tensor will not vanish, and I cannot make it vanish by going to some coordinate frame.
Equivalence principle is just like four first derivatives.
Yeah, exactly. Up to first derivative.
If then you don't really have an equivalence principle.
That's right. Yeah. No, it tells you about information about the metric and the first derivatives of the metric.
So it is approximately.
No, it's approximately. It's an exact statement, right? So at a point, I can do this. but it's only up to a first derivative of the metric. So it means I can get rid of the gravity, but only to the quadratic order in the vicinity of the point. All right. So now we have this invariant volume element. So how do we do that? So first, let us notice, so remind that we know that the metric transforms as a 0 to tensor. So if you want, g mu nu prime at x prime is dx alpha dx prime mu dx beta dx prime nu g alpha beta at the point x. Okay, so that's how the metric has to transform, the coordinates of the metric, the components of the metric, how they have to transform. So now let's find what the corresponding determinant is. So now let's define the G to be determinant of the metric, G mu nu. And of course, because one of the eigenvalues is negative, this will be a negative number. So now let's see how this determinant actually transforms under change of coordinates. So we can apply determinant on both sides of this thing. So then we have that determinant of g prime mu nu, which we just call g prime. Okay. And on the right-hand side, we have this object here, which is like a matrix, this object here, which is like a matrix, and then this object here, which is a matrix. So now the determinant of the product of matrices is just the product of determinants of these matrices. So then this must be equal to determinant of dx alpha over the x prime mu times determinant of dx beta dx prime mu times determinant of g alpha beta, which we call g. Okay, determinant of g alpha beta. Okay, so now you probably have seen this thing here. It's nothing else than the Jacobian of the transformation x to x prime. Okay, so I can equally write this, and so this will be a Jacobian, you know, going from x prime to x. But if I want to go from x to x prime, it's just one over that. Okay, so I can also write this as the Jacobian dx prime over dx. So Jacobian means, well, it's typically written like it's a determinant, right? But now this is 2 power minus 2, and the determinant of g alpha beta is g. So we just concluded that g prime actually transforms in this way. But if you look at this, this is a very suspicious transformation, right? So g, the determinant of the metric, has no indices. Okay, so you might expect that the determinant of the metric transforms as a scalar. Okay, but if it did transform as a scalar, you would have to find that g prime of x prime is g of x. But we are not finding that. We are finding this extra thing. And so the determinant of the metric is actually not a scalar, but it's a different quantity. The quantity is called a scalar weight. So it's called, let's say, scalar. So g is a scalar density instead of just a scalar of weight minus 2 or plus 2 of weight plus 2. And so if you would define that a scalar weight, scalar density of weight w would transform according to, so you would have phi prime is dx prime over dx, the determinant of that phi, and then there's minus w here. Okay, so this is how a general scalar density of weight w would transform. And so you see the determinant is simply an example of set of that for w equals 2 plus 2. Okay. So That's good. So we know how a determinant transforms. So not everything actually is described in general, but is described by scalars and tensors and vectors. But we have also other objects which almost transform a scalar, but apart from this part here. Okay. So now, why is this useful? Is that if you look at the volume of the spacetime, so now consider the volume of the spacetime. And so if you do, so this is the volume of the spacetime. And if you naively just write that as d for x prime, so this is how it looks in my new coordinates. So I'll define my volume of the spacetime just d4 of x. So now in the new coordinates, I have dv prime is d4 x prime. And of course, you know that under the change of coordinates, you pick up a Jacobian of the transformation. So this will be equal to d x prime over dx. That's the corresponding Jacobian. And then d4 of x, which is dx prime over dx times dv. So actually, the spacetime volume, if you just define it to be d4 of x, then it's also not a scalar. So this will be another scalar density, but now of the weight minus 1. So this is also a scalar density, scalar density of w equals to minus 1. All right. So now we have a problem, not really, but the solution is obvious, is that if we want this, you know, the spacetime volume, if you want to write down a spacetime volume which is a scalar, which is invariant under coordinate transformations, you just combine the two things. Okay, we know that this thing transforms as a scalar density of weight plus 2, and this one as scalar density of minus 1. So if we combine them in a nice way, they will transform as a scalar. Maybe. Yes?
Shouldn't be partial x over x prime?
Oh, I think this is dx over dx prime.
Because you have the weight is minus 1.
I believe this is correct, but is it? This is fine. So I think it's fine. So now we can introduce an invariant volume element, which will be a scalar, which is a scalar, not a scalar density, just true scalar. And it's just combining, you know, whatever the volume is, plus how the metric transforms. And so this we'll call this and define that to be square root of minus g d4 of x. Okay, so let's go tilde here and tilde here. So just to distinguish that dv is different from our new dv. So that's the definition of the invariant scalar element. And so now, of course, this thing will have weight minus 1, but now I'm taking square root of minus g, so that will have a weight plus 1. And so in the end, the whole total thing will transform as a scalar. Okay? So this is, so instead of integrating over d4 of x, as you are used in special relativity, we will actually have to be integrating over d4 of x square root of minus g. Okay? In order this integral to be actually a scalar quantity. Okay, so that's how general relativity enters into the formulation.
Sorry, why is that not? So the g is.
So g is the determinant of the metric.
Right. So that's a net one.
So you know that g transforms like this thing to minus 2. Mm-hmm. Now if I take square root of of g, it will transform as this thing to power minus 1, and that will precisely cancel this plus 1 here, which you see there. Thanks for that question. All right, so now just to tell you that, well, we will not really need it, but Another example of scalar of density rather than a tensor, so of tensor density now, tensor density is the permutation symbol which we called previously the Levi-Civita tensor. Is permutation symbol. Symbol. And so what the permutation symbol is, well, we were writing previously this epsilon, and then we were putting some indices, mu nu, kappa lambda. So now let's, instead of that, write epsilon mu nu kappa lambda. So that's the permutation symbol. And it was defined to be plus one, if we had 0, 1, 2, 3, and even permutations of that. And it was defined to be -1 for, I swapped the 2, so it's 1, 0, 2, 3, and even permutations. And then it was defined to be 0 otherwise. So this is like the four-dimensional Levi-Civita tensor, four-dimensional version of the Levi-Civita tensor, which you know is in three dimensions. All right, but now the statement is this object actually is not a tensor in general relativity. This object, when it actually transforms, it will precisely pick up this dx prime over dx determinant to some power. And so to kill this power, it's again, it's weight of -1, I think. So to actually form a tensor, you need to multiply this object by the corresponding square root of the determinant of the metric. Okay, and so the statement is that we can define a Levi-Civita tensor, which is now really a tensor, and that's simply given by epsilon mu nu kappa lambda to be square root of minus g, and then mu nu kappa and lambda. Okay. So this object will actually behave as a tensor. And so this object is not a tensor, it's a tensor density. But once I multiply by square root of minus g, it will be a tensor. Okay, and similarly, you can write this with indices up. But now if you write this with indices up, something strange happens, and actually the square root of g has to be at the bottom. So if you want to define it with indices up, kappa lambda, of course, this object is just obtained from that object by raising the indices with the help of the metric. But anyway, so this thing then will have square root of minus g at the bottom, and then mu nu kappa lambda. This is how the object would look like if it's this indices up. So actually having the determinant of the metric, which is not a scalar, but is something else, is actually quite useful, because whenever you see tensor densities or scalar densities or whatever, I can make them to scalars by simply multiplying by the corresponding power of g of the metric. So if you are interested in, you know, how this is proved, it's done in the lecture notes, but it's not important, and we will not use it anywhere. So questions? No questions. So part E is the parallel transport okay, and so if you want a definition, so definition, so consider kev gamma parametrized by lambda by the corresponding parameter lambda. Then you say we define a directional derivative, a directional covariant derivative along lambda, along gamma, along this curve, is defined as follows. So is for a vector V given by, so now do a derivative of that vector V. Let's do it in components. So I want to change the vector V along the curve. So I'm differentiating with respect to the lambda along the curve. And it's given by, okay, I'll write it down and then I'll explain the following picture, lambda mu V alpha, which sometimes people write as lambda U V alpha, or lazy people just write it as V alpha dot. Okay, so that's what it is. Now what is the picture? So I consider my curve. This is my curve gamma. So this curve is parameterized by the parameter lambda. So as I go along this curve, I change my parameter lambda. And this curve has a tangent vector associated with it, which is u mu, which is dx mu over d lambda in some coordinates. So that's my tangent vector. That's the tangent vector. And then basically the directional derivative along this curve is that if I take any other vector v, I just drag this vector along the curve. So this will be v later. And I just drag it along the direction of the curve. But of course, it means is that I am basically dragging along the tangent vector of that curve, not like u. Okay. So that's the corresponding picture, and that's what the directional derivative is. Questions? It makes sense. Yes.
Are you dragging it along the direction of the curve, or is your v changing to be tangent to the curve?
No. So okay. So I have a tangent vector which is defined everywhere along the curve. That's my vector u. Okay. It's not a tangent vector, but almost. So this will be u, and that will be u, and whatever. So I have a tangent vector to that curve, which is u. Okay, so but now what you are doing is that you are basically parallel transporting, you are moving the vector v, which is given here, along this curve. And so the prescription how you move it along this curve is this one here. Okay, so whatever that means, I just start with some v here, and I just drag it along the curve, and the definition is here, how you drag it. Okay, so that's what you do. Okay, so that's definition number one. Definition number two is that you say that the vector is parallel transported if this operation which you were just doing is actually equal to zero. So it's parallel transporting along gamma, if lambda u v alpha equals to zero. So if this thing here, which we just defined above, is actually zero. If the directional derivative along gamma of that vector is equal to zero. So then we say that the vector v alpha is parallel transported. Okay. But now we can use the definition of our covariant derivative. And so now we know how to covariantly differentiate vectors. It's just given by the partial derivative plus the gamma term. Okay, so if you just plug it there, this thing here, so this will be. So definition of covariant derivative. So this will be given by u mu and then d mu of v alpha plus gamma mu beta v beta alpha. Okay. So that's what it is, just from the definition of the covariant derivative. And so now what we can do is that we can write d, well, u mu as we were putting in this picture in some coordinates. So it's dx mu over d lambda. Okay, so now this is equal to dx mu over d lambda, and then whatever we are writing here, so it's dv alpha dx mu, and then plus gamma alpha mu beta v beta. Okay, so that's what it is. So now if you look at the first term here, so we have dx mu d lambda dv alpha over dx mu. So what it is really dv alpha over d lambda. So this is equal to dv alpha over d lambda. And then I can put it here. So it's plus gamma alpha mu beta. And let me write back u mu. So u mu and then v beta. And so what you require is that this is equal to 0. So that's your equation of the parallel transport of the vector v alpha. All right. So basically, you know, by requiring that this is equal to 0, you sort of want, so if you are in flat space where the gammas actually do vanish, then what you are requiring that the dv alpha over d lambda is equal to 0. In other words, the components of the vector do not change. So if you were in flat space, my parallel transported vector would be such that the components of the vector stays the same as I drag it along the geodesic. Of course, in curved space, this will modify that, but it's like a curved space generalization of, you know, transporting the vector so that it remains the same. Okay, so this is a generalization. Of the desire to keep the vector constant, of keeping the vector constant. Okay, so that's what a parallel transport means. So that's definition number two. Finally, a definition number three is what we might mean by geodesic. So a geodesic is a curve, for which or along which the tangent vector is parallel transported. So basically what you require is that if you start Okay. So that if you take the tangent vector along this curve, the tangent vector is moving, is changing as little as possible, as dictated by something like this. So what it, of course, what it means is that now I'm applying this not to an arbitrary vector v alpha, but to the tangent vector itself. Okay, so what you require is that nabla u of u alpha is equal to 0, which is obviously du alpha d lambda plus gamma alpha beta delta u beta u delta equals to 0. And that's our geodesic equation, which we derived previously. All right, so geodesic equation is such that the tangent vector actually is parallel transported, which is like a generalization of a straight line, right? So really, this is a generalization of the straight line. So, straight line. Questions? These are just definitions, right? So we cannot really argue with definitions. So definitions are what they are. All right. But you see that, you know, these definitions lead to exactly the same equation as we had before. We derive that equation as something else. We derive it by extremizing the proper time or something like that, right? So for us, the geodesic was something which was extremizing the proper time. Here, the geodesic is really something intuitively which is a generalization of the straight line. In GR, these two concepts actually coincide. So almost the straight line is the line which extremizes the proper time. Okay? If you have more general theories of gravity, like if you had torsion and if you had other things, they can be different. Okay? So that's another thing why you don't want to mess with these assumptions, is that if you have torsion and if you have other things, then actually a generalization of the straight line and extremization of the proper time give you different curves. Okay? So that's what geodesics are. Now, what is important about the parallel transport is that it sort of preserves the angle, as you will see in a minute. But what is also very nice and you know, super useful about geodesics and the parallel transport is that it allows to define quite general symmetries, which are described by Killing vectors. Okay, so let's go. Let's have a remark here on Killing vectors. So first look. At Killing vectors, okay, and so let us now consider a geodesic gamma. So let gamma be a geodesic and then it has the tangent vector u with tangent vector u, and so we know because it's geodesic, it satisfies nabla u on u alpha equals to 0. Okay, and so let us have another vector field psi. And so let psi be another vector. And then let us consider a scalar quantity which is given by a product of these two vectors. So it's u times psi. So consider a scalar let's write it as C, which is given by U times Xi. So or in components, it's just U alpha, Xi alpha. So this is a special scalar, which is given by your vector Xi, and it's linear in the velocity of your geodesic U. Okay, so this is linear in U. Okay, so for example, if you may be thinking about the geodesic as sort of describing a physical motion of a particle, right? So we know that geodesics, that the particles move, free particles move on geodesics. So you may be thinking about U, the corresponding four velocity of that particle, and so this is the corresponding geodesic equation here. And so now what we are saying is, well, let's have another vector Xi, and let's form a quantity which is linear in the four velocity of the particle. So linear in U, which you can think about as the four velocity of the particle. Okay, so now what we require is that this thing is actually parallel transported along the geodesic. So we have some scalar, C, and so let this be parallel transported along our geodesic gamma. So we require C be parallel transported. And then what we will have to do is actually, you know, parallel transporting along any such gamma, along any such geodesic gamma. Okay, so what are we getting out of this? So we have that 0 is C dot. Okay, so if I transport this scalar quantity along the geodesic, it's equal to 0. So that's what means that it's parallel transported. Of course, I have to be a little bit more specific. So what it means is that I am taking the covariant derivative with respect to U of this thing here, U alpha, Xi alpha. All right. So this is a covariant derivative. And so it obeys the Leibniz rule. So I can on this term or on that term. So the first term will be, okay, so this is nothing else by definition as U beta nabla beta, right? So that's how I define this nabla U. Okay, so now if I act with this derivative on this guy, I'm getting that this is equal to U beta Psi alpha, okay, U beta nabla beta on U alpha Psi alpha. So I'm just differentiating this thing here, and then I differentiate the other one, so it will be U beta U alpha nabla beta Psi alpha. Everybody happy? Okay. So now, anybody can tell me what the first term is? It's zero because?
It's a geodesic.
It's a geodesic. Exactly. So this thing is zero because of the geodesic, so the first term is zero. Okay. What about the second term? So the second term has two terms, right? It has the term U alpha U beta, and then here's the term nabla beta Xi alpha. So now, of course, this thing here is symmetric under the change of alpha and beta, right? The first is why I have U U. So then this means that only the symmetric part of this thing actually contributes, okay? So, but I require that this is equal to zero for any geodesic. If it's equal to zero for any geodesic, these U's are arbitrary. If they are arbitrary, what it means and how I can satisfy that is that I have to require that this is equal to zero. Okay, so we are getting a beautiful equation for our vector Xi. And so we are getting an equation that, so this is a symmetrization there. So we are getting that nabla alpha Xi beta plus nabla beta Xi alpha has to be equal to zero for our vector field Xi. is the famous Killing equation. So it's not killing anybody. Killing is a guy, or was a guy. So this is his equation. And so the solution of this equation is, of course, this special field Xi, which is called Killing vector. A Killing vector. OK, so this is the fastest way to Killing vectors, to introducing Killing vectors. So in other words, if we want to have a quantity which is linear in particles for velocity u, and so this quantity is preserved along the geodesic. So for example, we are talking about the energy, or we are talking about the angular momentum, or something like that. Right? So we are talking about some conserved quantity along the geodesic, which is linear in the for velocity of the particle. And so if we require that this is true and is given by some vector field Xi alpha, this vector Xi alpha has to be very special. It has to satisfy this Killing vector equation, which is written over here. And OK. So now, of course, so we have a conserved quantity. Quantity C for our geodesic, for geodesics. Okay. So the energy along our particle motion is conserved. But of course, by Noether's theorem, we know that these conserved quantities are typically associated with some symmetries. Okay, so we have to have some nice continuous symmetry, which actually gives us this conserved quantity C. So this symmetry is the symmetry of the metric of the spacetime, if you want, and it's precisely described by this vector field. So Xi alpha is the symmetry of spacetime. You will see that what this equation is telling you is that the lead derivative of the metric with respect to this vector Xi is actually zero. So that's what that equation is. And what it's telling you is that my metric is not changing as I move in a special direction in the spacetime given by the vector field Xi. Okay, so if I have a special direction in the spacetime, following which the metric does not change, this is expressed by this equation, the lead derivative of the metric with respect to this vector field is zero. This is exactly this equation here. Then I have a symmetry. But because I have a symmetry, I must have a corresponding conserved quantity C, which is precisely given here for geodesics. Okay, so more generally, of course, if you have a symmetry of the spacetime, it doesn't only mean that you will have a conserved quantity for geodesics, but it means that I will have conserved quantities for other motions as well. Right? So I have a symmetry, so then for any given motion, I will have the corresponding conserved quantity. But for geodesics, it's simply given by this conserved quantity here. Yes?
That's fine. So at the beginning, we said that we're considering C to be parallel transport. So we imposed that.
OK. So we wanted to derive this equation. Of course, now we can go back. Right? So now we can say, well, I have a vector field Xi, which satisfies the equation. OK.
OK, once we have that, then we get our.
Yeah. So I derived the requirement of the vector Xi by requiring I have this conserved quantity. Mm-hmm. But of course, everything here is sort of equivalent, right? So I can start from here. I can say I have a symmetry of the metric. This is that. Well, I notice if I know what the lead derivative is, it can be written as this. Okay. If I have this, I can form a quantity C, which looks like u alpha Xi alpha. And look how it actually parallel transports along the geodesic. So I have these two terms here. The first one is zero because of the geodesic motion. The second one, because of this equation, is also zero. So I find C dot is equal to zero. So C will be my conserved quantity for geodesics. OK, so Killing vectors, very, very important. You will have a whole tutorial about Killing vectors next week. where you will derive this equation in a different form. Basically, you will be requiring that the metric is actually does not change as you move along the vector field xi. And then you will arrive at exactly the same equation. Questions?
So what's the physical meaning that the conservative quantity is linear in the?
Okay, so I'm saying if I have a Killing vector, I can write a conserved quantity for the geodesics, and this quantity will be linear in the forward velocity of the particle. Okay? So that already tells you that maybe there are some conserved quantities which are not linear in forward momentum, but they will not be described by Killing vectors. They will be described by something else. There will be other symmetries, hidden symmetries in the space-time, which actually generalize the notion of a Killing vector, and then I will have corresponding conserved quantities for particles. All right, so we have Killing vectors. So last thing I want to discuss about parallel transport is, well, basically it's another motivation for why we want metricity condition. So let V and W be two vectors transported, parallel transported, parallel transported along gamma. Okay, so what it means is that we have that V dot equals to 0 equals to W dot. Okay, so we fix gamma, and let's have two vectors V and W, which are parallel transported along gamma. So we have that. So now let us consider a scalar product of these two vectors. And let's look at what it actually, how is it parallel transported along the graph as well. So what about the parallel transport of their scalar product? So V times W, okay? So now we have a scalar product, which is something like cosine theta in between them, right? If they are normalized, let's say they are normalized, V square and W square is 1. So then this will just be cosine theta, how the angle changes between the two vectors as I transport it along my geodesic gamma, okay? So this is what it is. So now, of course, this is Naplai U on, okay? V alpha, what I mean by the dot here is, of course, the product in terms of the metric. So it's V beta G alpha beta. That's what it means, right? That's what the scalar product is. Okay, so very good. So now I have to use the Leibniz rule, and I will have three terms, right? So I will differentiate this thing here and leave the other two. Then I will differentiate this one here. And then I'll differentiate the metric. Okay, so what happens if I differentiate V alpha? You get 0 by assumption. Okay, so we get 0. Then we differentiate W beta. We get 0. Okay, so finally we differentiate G. So it's V alpha W beta Naplai U G alpha beta. Okay, very good. So that's what it is. So now, if we are in GR, what is the last term equal to? It's equal to 0 in GR. So in GR, because we have metricity condition. So this is 0 in GR because we have the metricity equal to 0. So in other words, the scalar product, the cosine theta in GR, will not change. So if I parallel transport two vectors along a geodesic, the angle in between them will remain constant, no matter how I do that. Okay. So, but if I don't impose metricity condition, that it will change. This is another motivation why you want to actually impose metricity condition. So this will be 0 in GR. if the metricity condition vanishes, and that's why you want to impose the metricity condition to vanish. Again, another motivation, right? You want the angle of the two vectors to be preserved if you parallel transform them along. Okay? So that's another reason for metricity. Sorry?
It's related to SO3.
To SO3? Why to
SO3? Because you want to preserve like the norm to a group, a rotation group.
Well, I'm not really doing any rotations here, am I? Well.
But you're like preserving the norms.
Okay. You will see something. All right. So now, of course, this will be true also if you have a geodesic and you have a tangent vector. And then you parallel transport a new vector along this geodesic. Of course, the angle in between the tangent vector and this vector has to remain the same. So the cosine theta has to be the same. So specifically, okay, so along a geodesic loop. All right. So let's consider a geodesic loop with the tangent vector u. So what it means is that if I have a geodesic loop here, and there's a tangent vector u here, then if I have any other vector which is parallel transported along this geodesic loop, v, so then this angle has to remain the same. Okay, so now the tangent vector, of course, is parallel transported. So this is my vector u, how it looks later on. But so then I know how to transport vector v, because this angle has to be preserved. So then this will be my vector v. And later on, this is u. And so this will be my vector v, and so on. Okay. So now you might be thinking, well, okay, so I know how to parallel transport my vector v. So I do it all the way to the point where I started. Okay, so now the question is, do I get the same vector v as I started with or not? Okay, so if you go all the way to the point, go all the way to point I started, do I get the same v? And the statement is that in flat space, yes, you do. In curved space, you don't. So this is actually the way how you characterize that the space is curved. So, no, in curved space. And a very nice picture which can actually convince you about this is this, you know, you all consider the motion on a sphere. So, example would be a motion on the sphere. So now I have this big circle, and then I have a big circle here, and another big circle there. Okay, so now let us consider the trajectory, you know, traveling to Africa, traveling to North Pole, traveling back to Ontario. Okay, so this is our closed loop. And let me start with a vector v, which looks like this.
But this loop is now smooth.
Oh, you can smooth it out, doesn't matter.
how is not a smooth can be a geodesic?
Sorry?
I think geodesic must be smooth.
Well, does it?
If you move on the grid circle, then you'd come back to the same point.
No, but why does it have to be smooth? So it's set on the geodesic between these two points, and then it's geodesic between these two points. So it's like I'm constraining geodesic. I'm imposing some extra constraints on the geodesic. Well, anyway, so yeah, it's geodesic everywhere, but
at the point.
But the point. So okay. Well, anyway, so if I transport this, of course, the tangent vector is this way, that way, and that way. Okay, so I have to preserve the angle. I keep moving the vector v, and it moves like that. Okay, but now I move it along this line, and there's a curve. So I'm moving it a little bit like that, and so it will basically looks like this. So it will be pointing that direction in the North Pole. And then I want to preserve this angle, so I move it this way. And I come back like this. Okay, so this is my V prime, and this is my V I started with. So you see that certainly if you do a parallel transport on the globe of the Earth, then you actually don't come back with the same vector V prime. And of course, that corresponds to the intuitive understanding that the surface of our Earth is actually curved. It's not a flat surface.
But the geodesic along the surface of the Earth, either like moving on the equator or on the longitude. So how is, I don't understand.
So I'm using part of that, right? So these are the big circles, and I'm just going, part. I'm going just a little bit along this big circle, and then I'm going a little bit along that big circle. So I'm going always geodesic apart from, it's not a smooth thing, but.
Yeah, but if you actually moved along the geodesic, then the direction of your vector won't change, right?
Of course it will. It will. Yeah, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, because the space is curved. It will. Yes?
I get that, okay, so you have it on a sphere. If you the geodesic are these paths around the circle.
Right.
This path and this path are both geodesics, but going it on and switching those curves is when you have something that's going in a straight line.
Well, the whole thing is not a geodesic, I agree. But everywhere locally it is a geodesic, right? Everywhere locally it is.
Why is it considered the same thing if you're doing a switch in this direction? If you have something that's moving on a straight line and then you have it move on a different straight line,
right?
It's still traveling along a geodesic, but something has changed in the system for it to go on a different.
No, but I arrive at this point, using this geodesic here, and this is my starting point for that geodesic here. So I think everything is fine. I don't see any problem you have with this. But anyway, so the statement is correct. So you can smooth it out if you want, but then it's not so nice, right? It's whatever. So anyway, so V goes to V prime, which are different. And they are, if you want, rotated. If you are in flat space, there won't be any rotation, and you arrive at the same vector V. If you are in curved space, there will be this rotation V to V prime, and that's a measure of how much the space is curved. Okay, so this is basically provides you an intuition for what it means a space to be curved. If I transport along a closed loop, I won't come to the same thing. Okay, so now this rotation is precisely described by the Riemann tensor. So I have a motivation in the study text where I actually say, well, the Riemann tensor precisely describes, how the vector v, if I go along the closed loop, changes to vector v prime. So now, in general, for a general manifold, this will be a general rotational transformation. That'll be your SO4 or whatever.
Yeah. But if we have if we don't have a compatible metric, metricity,
okay,
then we cannot have something like this.
Well, okay. So you can still have curvature, but of course, if you have torsion in addition to this, and if you have, then it becomes more complicated, of course.
Yeah, but it seems that the reason why we have this change in the angle is related to the fact that we have.
No. So here we are requiring that the angle actually does not change, and that's the effect of the metricity. Of course, if I had metricity, my angle would be changing. But I would still have a unique, way how to parallel transport things. It wouldn't preserve the angle. So I could still calculate how the vector changes, and it will still change. But I couldn't just draw this nice picture because I wouldn't know exactly how the vector is changing, right? But it would still change, and it would still rotate. And so this rotation is measured by the Riemann tensor. So this is the Riemann tensor. And if the Riemann tensor vanishes, you are in flat space. If it doesn't vanish, there will be a rotation, and you are in curved space. OK, so that's the formal definition, formal intuition. Well, that's an intuition behind what it means for the space to be curved. So now let's have a formal definition of the Riemann tensor. So part F, curvature. Part F is the curvature. And so let us introduce a tensor which measures, you know, how things are not flat. And the simplest way how you can actually define this tensor is through a commutator of covariant derivatives. So definition. So we define a Riemann tensor. Riemann tensor would be an object which has one index up and three down. So it's a rank 4 tensor. It's defined through the following relation. Well, I take a commutator of the two derivatives. So that's nabla mu, nabla nu, minus nabla nu, nabla mu. And act with this on a vector v rho. And if I get 0, I'll be in flat space. If I don't get 0, I have the Riemann tensor R rho sigma mu nu v sigma. Okay, so you define an object R rho mu nu sigma by this relation here. That's the definition of the Riemann tensor. Okay, and intuitively, what it corresponds to is, well, I may be moving, I may have a loop, closed loop, which is like nabla mu direction. This is the nabla nu direction. And so I go nabla mu, nabla nu, or I go nabla nu, nabla mu, and I parallel transport the vector along that. And do I actually come, do I get the same vector there? Or is there a difference? If there is a difference, this is precisely given by this thing here. If there is no difference, then this is what it is. But anyway, so this is the definition. And again, nobody can argue with the definition. It's the definition of the Riemann tensor. So now, is it obvious that it has to look, that the right-hand side has to look like this? Is it obvious or not? So the left-hand side, if you look at it, contains, well, first derivative, second derivative. So if I'm looking at the left-hand side, I can have up to two derivatives of the vector v. Of course, this is not so simple because I have partial derivative plus the gamma term, right? So now, do I actually really have anywhere two derivatives, two partial derivatives of my vector? What do you think?
Huh? Should they cancel out?
Because? Exactly. So very good. So the left-hand side actually is obviously not a function of two derivatives of the v, because I have a commutator, and the partial derivatives, they commute. OK, so if the partial derivatives act on v, then they will cancel. OK, what about the first derivatives? Is it obvious that I can cancel the first derivatives? Because if you look at the right-hand side, there are no derivatives of v. Right, there is just something here, some beast standing in front of v, but v is not differentiated. Okay, so is it obvious that I can cancel the first derivatives?
With the the Christoffel symbols are symmetric, so maybe it's specific.
And by saying that they are symmetric, you are imposing
that we are in GR and torsion is zero.
And the torsion is zero. Exactly. Thank you so much. So actually, if you did have torsion, there would be a first derivative term on the right-hand side. Okay? But we have no torsion in GR, and that's why only the absolute term is actually here. So outside of GR, so if torsion is non-trivial, right-hand side would pick up extra term. Which would be something like minus g sigma mu nu nabla sigma v rho. Okay, so this term would exist on the right hand side. If we had non-trivial torsion, that corresponds to that to the fact that I can actually differentiate once my vector v. But we have zero torsion, and that's why this commutator is simply given by the absolute term, no derivatives on v whatsoever. And this absolute term is given by the Riemann tensor. All right, so now it's painful, but you can actually write down the explicit expression in terms of the gammas, right? So I now write my nabla nu as partial nu plus gamma term, and I write nabla mu as partial mu plus gamma term. And so then you actually have to write it explicitly, everything down. And that gives you the prescription for the Riemann tensor. Okay, so now, of course, it's intuitive that the partial derivative can act on the partial derivative as well, but also on the gamma term. So I will have terms which are so Riemann will depend on the gamma term, but it will also depend on the derivative of the gamma term, right? Okay, so here it is. So it follows from the definition. That we can write Riemann in the following way: R rho sigma mu nu. It's a pain. Okay, so it's d mu. So that's the derivative of gamma rho nu sigma minus d nu gamma rho mu sigma plus gamma rho mu lambda gamma lambda nu sigma minus gamma rho mu lambda gamma lambda mu sigma. Okay, so that's what you can derive from this definition. If you don't believe me, please try it yourself. All you have to do is just to use the formula for the covariant derivative. All right. So now, of course, this looks like a big beast, and it is a big beast. But there's a very nice rule how to remember this. So you see, I have a derivative of gamma here, and then I have minus derivative of gamma here. So this is actually nothing else than d gamma minus d gamma. And then I have a gamma gamma term. So it's plus gamma gamma, and then minus gamma gamma. And so this is how it looks like. So this is the Riemann tensor. It's d gamma minus d gamma, and gamma gamma minus gamma gamma. All right? And so the way how you actually write down the indices can be sort of reconstructed from the symmetries of the Riemann tensor. So it obvious from the definition is that I define Riemann tensor to be a commutator of the derivatives mu nu. Okay, so what it means is that the left-hand side is antisymmetric in mu and nu. So must be the right-hand side. So immediately mu and nu index has to be antisymmetric between the two. And that's why, for example, if you look at this term and that term here, this term is exactly the same as that term. The only thing is that they swap the mu nu to be nu mu, I put a minus sign there. Okay, so this you can actually write up to a sign or up to something. Okay, so this is the way how you can actually reconstruct the full formula. All right. Okay, so we have a Riemann tensor. We have an explicit expression for the Riemann tensor. So now why Riemann tensor is useful is precisely whether we have flat space or not. So let's have a definition. So we have a definition. We say that space-time is flat. Is flat. And if there exists a coordinate transformation so that in the new frame, the metric is simply given by the flat metric everywhere. So the everywhere is super important. Of course, we know that we can always do it at a point by the equivalence principle. But the fact is that everywhere in the spacetime, I have to find this global coordinate transformation, which is valid everywhere, which brings my metric to the flat form everywhere in the spacetime. OK? So that's a definition, what it means to spacetime to be flat. Of course, this is a super annoying definition, because it may take you a lifetime to find the right coordinate transformation, which brings your metric to the flat form, right? So that's it's a favorite nasty problem for your exam, is that your teacher gives you a metric and asks, is this metric flat? OK? And so if you were to really probe all the coordinate transformations which might bring this metric into the flat case, you know, it may take you forever and you will never finish your exam. Okay, so there must be a nice check whether this is actually possible. And so the theorem is, the theorem is that the space-time is flat. If and only if, the Riemann tensor vanishes. Of course, it doesn't give you a prescription how to find the corresponding transformation, but at least you know. If you calculate the Riemann, and so if you know the metric, you can calculate the gammas. If you know the gammas, you can calculate this beast. If this beast vanishes, then you know you are actually in flat space, but your metric just doesn't look flat because you are in the wrong coordinate system, right? But if it does not vanish, then you know that the transformation is not possible. So this is the check. This is the thing which you should do if you are given such a problem. Not that I will give you such a problem. All right, so that's how you recognize whether the space-time is actually flat or not. All right, so now another funny business is to really calculate the components of the Riemann tensor and to look at its symmetries. So I was trying to argue that the Riemann tensor really should be capturing the information, the non-trivial information, about the second derivatives of the metric. And we know that there is at most 20 such components. All the others we can make zero. Okay, so it would make sense if the Riemann tensor actually had 20 components. So let's check that it indeed does. So now let's look at the symmetries of the Riemann tensor. Yep.
You probably like diagonalize this matrix, and then the diagonal matrix should probably correspond to the flat metric, and the two matrices should correspond to the coordinate transformation that you can do to get this G. So would that be easier than
Well, you can, So you can try to do it like locally at a point, right? You can try to diagonalize the matrix, and then you can find the corresponding coordinate transformation. And then what you would have to check somehow that this is a global transformation, that if I go to a different point, then you can still diagonalize that, right? So to diagonalizing a matrix is possible at a point, right? So I fix a point, and then I diagonalize it. But the problem is that the coordinate transformation will depend on the point, right? So in general, so it's quite tricky actually. All right.
Does that mean, so like we can go from flat space and then do like a coordinate transformation to get into like a spherical coordinate system?
Uh-huh.
And like we can have a metric that describes that spherical coordinate system. So does that mean that that's actually flat, like a metric that's just—
Exactly. That's what it means precisely. So if you, I just do a coordinate transformation on something which is flat, I'll just end up with a flat metric just written in a different coordinates in a more complicated way, but I will not change the statement about the Riemann tensor. So if the Riemann tensor was originally zero, it will be zero no matter which coordinate transformation I do, and the space-time is still flat.
Okay, so like in a spherical system, if the Riemann tensor is zero.
So if you just introduce a spherical system, Riemann tensor will be zero,
okay,
and it's still flat space, just written in spherical coordinates.
But
of course, this thing here is not just introducing spherical coordinates, right?
Yeah.
This thing is truly, truly curved, right? So the sphere is actually curved.
How is it different from just like tracing like a constant r, like in a spherical coordinate system? Like, what's the difference between?
There are these different curvature tensors. One is in a two-dimensional thing, and the other is in a three-dimensional thing.
Spherical coordinate system.
Yeah. But I mean, if you don't want to calculate the Riemann tensor of that spherical coordinate system, you want to calculate the Riemann tensor of the r equals big r coordinate system, right? Where you fix r. That's what describes the sphere. You fix
in
r.
In the sphere, you can see like an stereographic projection. And then in a stereographic projection and a sphere, one of the, so, well, you have a manifold in the sphere. So you have like all the points in the upper half of the sphere are going to be projected to a plane. And then in that way, you can think that it is like flat, but it is not flat because you have two patches. So it is a manifold. So it is a way you can transform from the sphere, from the spherical coordinates to something that is plane. But it is a manifold because you have two patches, one for the North Pole and one for the South Pole. So it is still a sphere. It is not a plane.
So anyway, if I think about the sphere as embedded in the 3D Euclidean space, then 3D Euclidean space is actually flat, right? So if I use that metric, you know, that's flat. But now if I actually restrict myself to live on the sphere, it will actually be curved. If you understand it as a 2D space, now with its own metric, it will be curved. Of course, this curved metric is induced from the three-dimensional flat metric of the Euclidean space, but actually it will not be flat. You will see that the Riemann tensor is actually non-trivial. All right, so now if you want to discuss the symmetries of the Riemann tensor and to show that really it has only 20 components, it's useful to introduce this object where you just lower the first index of the Riemann tensor. And then written in this way, the Riemann tensor has super nice symmetries. So the symmetries can be written as such. So it will be antisymmetric in the last two indices. Okay, we already know that by the definition, because it's given by the commutator of the two derivatives. It will also be antisymmetric in the first two indices, but it will be symmetric under the exchange of 2 and 2. So I can take these two, and I can take these two, and I can swap them, and it will be symmetric. So let me just write it. So for example, I know that it's antisymmetric by changing mu and mu, kappa lambda. Okay, so I just change the first two, and it's antisymmetric there. Or I can change the last two, and it's antisymmetric there. So it's r mu nu lambda kappa. Okay, but I can exchange the pairs of indices, and it will be symmetric there. So it's the same thing as r kappa lambda mu and nu. Okay, so this So these symmetries you can actually show from the definition and or from the explicit expression for the Christoffel symbols, through the Christoffel symbols. All right, so that's the symmetries. But there's another symmetry where actually if you take R and then you anti-symmetrize over all possible indices, you get zero. So anti-symmetrizing over everything, you also get zero. And these are the symmetries. Oh, that's the symmetries. By the way, if you just combine these symmetries with those symmetries, people sometimes like to write instead of this one. So it follows from here, that also R nu kappa lambda cyclic permutation is equal to zero. So if I take the indices R mu nu kappa lambda and then I add R lambda nu kappa and then I add R kappa lambda nu, that will also be zero. Okay, but it's a consequence of these symmetries here. All right, so that's the symmetry. So now how many components it has? Because these are the symmetries. And so the statement is, well, it's quite entertaining to calculate how many components it has. And the trick is, so you take the Riemann mu nu kappa lambda, and then you know it's anti-symmetric here, anti-symmetric here, but it's symmetric under the exchange. So let's call this mu nu indices a new capital big index A, and these two indices new capital big index B. Okay, so then the question is how many, so mu and nu indices, they run from 0 to 3, so they have four different choices. Or in D dimensions, they have D different choices. So in D dimensions, the indices mu run from 0 to D minus 1, so they take D choices. What about the index A in D dimensions? So it is, you can think about it like index A replacing two indices, but it has to be symmetric, anti-symmetric in these two indices. So how many choices I can make out of two indices so that they are anti-symmetric in D dimensions? Huh?
D square minus
D. D square, something like that. So it's the combinatoric number D over 2. So the index A runs from, well, whatever, has d over 2, which is d times d minus 1 over 2 choices. So let's call that number n, just for the moment. So we have that many choices for the index A. But now, of course, the index B is the same thing because it's anti-symmetric in kappa and lambda. But the whole object is symmetric on the exchange of A and B, right? I can change A and B, and it will be symmetric. So RAB is symmetric here. So if each index A takes and B takes n values, how many components RAB has? It's symmetric. So that's n times n plus 1 divided by 2, right? So now, so RAB can have n times n plus 1 over 2 components. Okay, so that's great. We know that RAB can have n times n plus 1 over 2, and n is given here. And so we have just considered all these symmetries here. These are the symmetries which we consider. But we still haven't considered this restriction. This restriction is telling you if I anti-symmetrize over all four indices, I have to get zero. How many equations is this in D dimensions? So So I'm choosing an object which is completely anti-symmetric in four indices, in d dimensions. So it's d over 4. Okay, so there is d over 4 restrictions due to constraint that r alpha beta gamma delta has to be equal to 0. So in other words, the total number of components of the Riemann tensor, so number of components of Riemann, is okay. So it's this thing here. So it's n times n plus 1 over 2 minus d over 4. Now I have to plug in for what n is. N is d times d minus 1 over 2. And so if you put everything together, you will find it's equal to d squared over 12, d squared minus 1. And that's the total number of components. OK, let's take d equal to 4. That's what we are interested in. So d equal to 4, well, this is 16 over 12. And this is 15. Hopefully it works. It should give you 20. All right. And this is precisely what we want. We want that the Riemann tensor has 20 non-trivial components precisely corresponding to 20 non-trivial second derivatives of the metric, which we can have. OK, this is one of the questions of the of the interview. So to calculate the, to tell me what the symmetries of the Riemann tensor are and what are the components of the Riemann tensor here. All right. So I'm running out of time, so let me stop here. We now know what the Riemann tensor is. So tomorrow we will write down the Einstein tensor, and then we will start discussing general relativity. OK?